Coming up, what an excellent day for a rest. This episode was brought to you by Calm.com. Are you feeling possessed? Are you feeling like there's a legion of demons wreaking havoc on your insides? Try Calm.com. And listen to the sounds. Listen to the soothing sounds of respirator breathing. Listen to the soothing sounds of two grown men yelling at you. I cast you out! You're not my mother! Sink into a delicious bowl of split pea soup as you drift off to sleep. It almost feels like the bed is floating, doesn't it? What's that? Your father's coming in here to wake you up. It's time for school. Snap his neck. You'll get up when you're goddamn ready.
Feels like your father's in the Mediterranean and can't even call you on your goddamn birthday.
Listen to the soothing sounds of your mother yelling at the operator for 30 minutes. And then the distant sounds of a blacksmith's hammer.
Are we going to do the whole movie?
Well, howdy, folks, and welcome to Minute 114 of The Exorcist Minute, a show where we endeavor to examine, extrapolate, and excavate The Exorcist, minute by terrifying minute. My name is Lester Ryan Clark.
And I'm Keenan Diaz.
And we'll be your holy guides on this journey through what some have called the scariest movie of all time. Okay, so our minute begins with a moment of calm.
And it ends with the moment of calm.
It's a little too calm. I don't like this. Something's up. Something's gonna happen. This is never good. No, I'm actually kidding. This is a much needed rest, a much needed break in the action. We are tired. The priests are tired. Reagan's tired, and Howdy's all tuckered out. poor little tyke.
That's right.
Poor little bugger. Poor little. Shit. But yeah, let's get to the top of this minute. Dimmy has been slowly limping over to the window, and now he drops out of frame to reappear with our old friend, the yellow blood. No, Burke.
Wait, you lost me.
Sorry, I was improvising the script. Like, he's going over to the window and he drops out of frame.
Yes, he pulls Burke up. they never saw the body.
All right, it was literally just out there on the top step. He just hit that top step and he's just been sitting there and he's just like,
nobody's even asking for me. It's been 3 days.
No. He reappears with our old friend, the yellow blanket.
Thank God. Yeah. I've been so worried about that blanket.
Remember, we thought that blanket had gone out the window. But then we spotted on the floor next to that faded carpet. Fated and faded. Mm-hmm. So Karis brings back the blanket to Reagan, covers her with it, falls on her with it. He falls on the bed, but he does it as if she's going to fly away again. Like, I like that touch. He's administering love and care with the energy of one who is like diving onto a grenade, right? Or like putting out a fire. Now, as all of this is happening, Marin has been rising from his kneeling position and none too steady. By the end of the shot, he has risen enough to sit on the bed. I like how we've swapped roles again. It's Marin who is finding his footing and Dimmy who is being proactive, right? Making decisions and acting by his heart. Right. Mm-hmm. He got the blanket for Reagan. He didn't, you know, just stand there wondering about the rules or if he should or, you know, he just did it.
Yeah. But in context, you know, so they've been thrown against this wall, essentially, like this psychic, psionic force, like, is throwing them together into this wall. And, mm-hmm. and then they're both getting up, and Damien seems to have a very hard time for it. And so, mm-hmm. we, you know, we're not, we don't see what he sees, so we're not sure what he's doing when he stumbles off camera towards us. And mm-hmm. and then he comes back, is like, oh, it's this blanket thing, and it's this really nice moment. So somehow, yeah. somewhere, even though... you know, presumably Reagan, Pazuzu, the devil, something has thrown mm-hmm. them against the wall. His instinct here as he's stumbling around is to go get this blanket for her. So he's right. already thinking ahead and, I don't know, forgiving her, I suppose, mm-hmm. for doing this to them and yeah. and thinking like, okay, well, you know, maybe the devil in her, the demon did this to me, but she's still a little girl in there and that's what we're here for.
Yeah. I love how the movie keeps reminding us that it's not Reagan we're fighting.
Mm-hmm, right.
Yeah. And it's in these little moments like this where we see Marin cleaning her up with a cloth or we see Dimmy coming in with a blanket, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, so then we cut and it's almost as if we're resting on that other end table mm-hmm. where the now fallen lamp used to be. We see the corner of the table, Marin's crucifix, the taut wire of mm-hmm. the lamp, and beyond the edge of the table, like a cliff overlooking a vista, we see our scene, our characters, all in or on that bed. I was gonna say this shot with all three of them in these poses, you know, like sick little girl in bed, dad on one side, grandpa or the doctor on the other side tending to her, right? Like tucking her in. Mm-hmm. I was gonna say, oh, if you look at this shot out of context, like maybe you would be like, oh, what a sweet family scene. But then I saw, you know, the bedposts and the purple stole and the lighting and the colors, right? There's too much of The Exorcist in here. You cannot mistake it for anything else.
Mm. Like it's Norman Rockwell, but through the Exorcist prism of the lighting and all the yeah. iconography. Yeah,
exactly. Right. More than any other place in this movie, this room, its dimensions, its look, its mood have infected our consciousness to the point where like we immediately identify it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I write these notes on my break at work during lunch and like people walk by my desk and they'll see the movie paused on a shot of like just a wall mm-hmm. or a cracked ceiling or the window. And they're like, oh, The Exorcist. I haven't seen that in years. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, like every inch of this goddamn room is like tattooed onto our brains.
Yeah. This third act especially has this, I hate to say it this way because I don't want to give a misunderstanding of the way that this works in the movie. Mm. But like, you know, like we'd say like The Exorcist filter, right? If you're on Snapchat or TikTok or something, you'd
right.
put The Exorcist filter and everything would have this purple blue coldness to it, right? And
mm-hmm.
And the thing about this yellow blanket and the yellow curtains that is so interesting is like how unyellow they look, right? And
right,
like,
yeah.
so I don't mean filter in the same way. Like, that's not what the filmmakers are doing. They're not putting on a LUT or a lookup table or something in post-production. You know, they're color timing it. They're taking their what they've shot, and it's designed to be purple and blue and cold.
Mm.
They've stripped out all of the decorations from this kid's room to make it look sterile, and they've changed the bed. And then they're going and color timing the film and actually, like, dipping the negative into certain chemicals to change the color. Mm-hmm. So when I say a filter, I don't mean it through like, you know, yeah, digitized. It's not digitized to look like this. Mm-hmm. They've done this work in production and in post-production. Yeah. But it looks very, very distinctive.
Yeah. If I was walking by and I just saw
mm-hmm.
the ceiling crack, right, which is just an insert shot, I'd be like, oh, I know what this movie is.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has that gauze to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, so in this shot, we got a classic Marin, classic gentle, compassionate, selfless Marin, mm-hmm. right? He's taken out a white cloth and is tending to Reagan. I looked, but I cannot see. Do we know exactly what he's doing? Is he cleaning up vomit? Is he tending wounds with maybe some like alcohol? His hands are behind her face. Mm-hmm. It looks like he's cleaning or wiping at first, but then it almost looks like he puts the cloth under her head at one point, like maybe like a mini support pillow. But then
sort of. But then he stands up with it. Yeah.
Yeah, he, after that, it also looks like he's like screwing something back up, like a bottle or something.
Like his holy water bottle, which is what I was thinking.
And he bends over and he puts it back on the table. Yeah,
maybe he's dabbing her with, you know. Oh, I don't know what else. What would you do that with? Like an open container of liquid and you would put a cloth over it just to get a little bit, you know. And
well, like rubbing alcohol.
Oh, yes, of course. Like rubbing alcohol.
Like to cut, you know, for cuts and stuff. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But with holy water, potentially? That's all we've seen him. We haven't seen him with alcohol.
No,
water.
You don't dab with holy water.
I don't think so, but he's doing that
with sprinkle
something.
It. You throw it.
You sprinkle it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not
do
for
you think
dabbing.
He has witch hazel, or he has rubbing alcohol with him.
Oh,
I don't know. We just didn't see it. Yeah, we just didn't get that in our inventory. But
yeah, he's got to have like him or Karis have got to have like some kind of like medical stuff to hand, right?
Right. But if this were Tarantino or Zombieland or something, it would be like here, you know, here's an inventory check, and we'd see every single thing that's in Marin's pack or whatever. Right.
They would open their cassocks and they'd be right. lined with stuff.
Yeah, go shh, 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 as we see every single one of them.
Yeah, right. Oh, actually, I just thought of something.
Mm-hmm.
It could even be communion. Like he put the cloth under her mouth to catch the crumbs, and he gave her the communion wafer. Because that is part of the ritual. Like when, you know, we were talking about Robbie Doe, like he's supposed to, you know, give him the communion, and he kept on like spitting it out.
Yes.
But now she's unconscious, so like this is an opportunity. It's like, oh yeah, get the communion wafer in there.
That's interesting. With Robbie Doe, they had parents' permission.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess... I don't know why I'm worried about that as an atheist. You know, like Chris McNeil's an atheist, and then she's got these priests coming in, and then they're slipping her communion. That wasn't part of the deal.
when you die, then the non-god is like, hey, did you eat something you weren't supposed to eat?
No, a priest made me do it.
Oh, sure. It's just always blame the priests. I thought you didn't believe in me, but now I see. But yeah, so they're on the bed and Marin is tending to Reagan. And even as he's tending to her, he asks Dimmy, he says, are you tired?
Yeah.
And I love that. Again, that's classic Marin, right? That is who he is, even on the edge of death. I mean, he might be feeling the first like signs of that heart attack right now, but he's checking on everyone else in that room. And Howdy's missing it. This is what makes Marin Marin. This is why he wins. This is why he is, forgiven by God. This is why he is loved. This is humans. This is what humans are. This is what they do. And as obsessed as Howdy is with figuring him out, like getting his size, putting him in his proper place like he did with everybody else, he's not here to see this. Or maybe he is. Maybe he's, you know, pretended to go away for a while. You know, he's fake sleeping. Actually, that's a good question. What do we think, Keenan? Is he here right now? Is he conscious? Is this calm of his own devising, or is it because he's like temporarily subdued?
I'm not sure. I think in the screenplay and perhaps in the book, it's implying that this is going to go a lot longer, where in the movie, it's pretty like go, 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 right? We sort of, when we have a brief break outside, it's going to be really brief, like surprisingly brief. Yeah. So I don't know, in the screenplay and perhaps the book, maybe it is, this is real.
That Howdy is
really out of it for a little while.
Okay.
Because then it takes a little while, and then, you know, and then he's gonna, you know, he's gonna kill Marin, right? He's gonna get Marin in there by himself. In the movie, I don't know if there's time for him to really be out and then like plan these things, because, you know, it just feels so quick. So then Damien comes back in the room, and then he's the mother, and then Damien goes away, and Marin comes in and he kills Marin. So I don't know. I think it's easier
Now we keep saying he kills Marin.
I'm gonna
say some things about that when that happens.
All right. Well, he blesses Marin at least when he passes. Well, but
bye, Marin.
But either way, like if it is a trick, Mm-hmm. If that's what you're saying, like this is him fainting, taking a break, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's more evidence of that, or it's easier to defend in the movie than in the original plan, the screenplay, and I think in the book. What do you think?
Yeah, I for some reason I read this as either Howdy is unconscious, like pretty much the same as like being gone, and the, right. you know we're looking at Reagan's sleeping form,
right.
Or Howdy is there, he's conscious, but he's too weak to do anything right now. He's biding his time. But he's not – I don't get the sense that he's faking, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he's – like, even if he is there, I don't think he's strong enough to, you know, pull anything with these two guys sitting right next to Reagan on the bed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think – he's either completely not there, or he's too weak to do anything at this point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I read it as he's really out.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
But yeah. So Marin has asked Dimmy if he's tired, still out of breath, though we can see his breath. Dimmy nods and manages a very weak. Yeah. Now that Marin's taking care of Reagan, Dimmy sits up and turns away, holding himself very much like Chris would hold herself in earlier minutes because, you know, there was no one to hold her, even in scenes with other people. And that's what Dimmy is doing here. He's with Marin, and Marin has just asked him if he's okay, but he's also still very much alone. He has that, he is that lonely black rain cloud, and he's holding himself, and he has turned away, but he's turned away towards us, and we can see the tiredness, the sadness. His mask is gone, but his thoughts are so inward. They're down so deep that even though this is Dimmy's real face here, it's a little hard to read beyond pure exhaustion. But I also see a little bit of revelation. This would be the first chance in all this chaos to sit down and be like, huh, so devil. Right? Like last time he was calmly sitting, he did not believe in the devil or God. And now he's sitting here catching his breath and he's like, well, I'll be damned. And then he's like, wait, am I?
Yeah, but it's also, you see that 8-foot tall ancient Mesopotamian statue that was here a second ago? You saw that, right? there's no indentation here in the rug.
Yeah. It's mysteriously vanished.
This is the first like moment of calm we've had at all. And he's sitting there. And this is the kind of thing I like, you know, like... On my first feature film as an actor, where I was one of the main actors, and so I was in almost every scene, you know, you realize how exhausting it is to make a movie. And, you know, I guess for non-actors, it could be, you know, oh, you just sit there and they put makeup on you. And like, I understand that because you're certainly not like doing like grip work or whatever and like actual physical work and stuff. But it's really exhausting. The nice thing about that movie, my first feature, was that I got to look tired a lot because our characters had stayed up all night and it was a horror movie and we'd been drinking and stuff. And I got to like just sit there a lot, just be like, well, I'm just going to show people what's really going on.
Yeah.
It's just so exhausting because, man, Jason Miller really sells this. He looks tired to the bone.
Yeah, he is done. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder how long this is in their shoots in this room.
Like,
because they did quite a lot of shooting in there, and it was very cold and very tiring.
Yeah, yeah, it could be. Yeah, so this tiredness that we're looking at could be Jason Miller's tiredness.
Yeah, he's really using it, as they say. Yeah. So just use that. That's the patronizing advice people give you, like when you're like, ugh, I'm in such a bad mood today or whatever. And they're like, well, use it.
Yeah.
And you're like, ugh.
Use this up your ass.
Yeah. It's always the right advice. It just never feels right to hear.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I had a really bad day. Great.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Your character's having a really bad day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I got to see Viggo Mortensen talk with Dennis Hopper. Dennis Hopper directed him in this movie. Huh. And so Dennis Hopper gave him the direction in a helpful way, I think. So Viggo Mortensen was like, I can't do this scene, you know, Dennis. I'm, you know, this happened last night, this happened. And I'm just in this weird place. I just don't have it in me. You know, this is so weird. And so instead of saying use that, which is the patronizing version of it,
right. Yeah,
Dennis Hopper had a nice way of saying it, which is, well, start there. Right. Start there. Like, as you know, you're going to move on from there, but start there.
Yeah. I like that. Okay.
Yeah. He's a good director.
Yeah. See that, folks? Mm-hmm. We got Aragorn being directed by
Frank Booth from Blue Velvet.
Well, I was going to say King Koopa. From the movie Super Mario Brothers, which is also canon. In addition to the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
Yep. Koopas are dinosaurs, I guess.
And cartoons. At the same time.
Wait. So in the Super Mario Brothers Super Show, it's like, hey, do the Mario Brothers, right? And they do the But there's also in the movie, there's everybody do the dinosaur.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So I guess that was just a thing back then. That's music that was like songs about you doing the dance that we've just named. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the era of you would just finish watching a movie, and then there would be a rap song telling you the entire story of the movie you just watched.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Was everybody do
and
the
we
dinosaur?
Loved it.
We didn't know any better. Was also do the Bartman.
Uh-huh.
Which you remember, right? Do the Bartman, dude. And then and then there was do the Urkel.
Yep. I remember.
Do you remember
that?
The Urkel?
Mm-hmm. I don't remember the actual dance. I just remember that phrase, do the Urkel, yeah.
If you want to do the Steve Urkel dance, all you got to do is hitch up your pants.
There we go. It's all coming back.
I imagine you end it with, did I do that or something
it's
like
gotta
that.
It's got to be. Yeah. So I think we're back to, you know, do the Exorcist. How would we do this? Do a little bit of spider walk. Spin your head around.
Yeah, you'll lick your nanny's ankles.
And murder your mom's best friend.
Yeah. Oh, in this, so again, my horror club at UNLV, Fright Club.
Yeah,
Fright exclamation point club. Yeah. So in this discussion, they screened The Exorcist, and in this discussion afterwards, they were commenting on like, oh, Reagan killing Burke because Burke represents like this you know, challenge to her old life, right? Like, oh, like marrying your mother, right?
Okay, yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's in the book for sure, right? That's sort of something that's going on, because Reagan's like, hey, you can marry Burke, and I brought up the idea that, you know, but Burke, she doesn't understand that Burke is Chris's gay best friend,
right?
Yeah, and the president of the Fright Club, a straight guy, was like, what? And then a bunch, all the queer kids in the back were like, uh-huh. And so the majority of them were like, yeah, Burke is gay and Dyer is gay. Some of them argued Damien is gay, which I don't think is there.
Yeah.
But this, because this relationship with like Damien and Dyer is so intimate.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh, that's a homoerotic thing. I don't think it is at all. Yeah. So I don't know. The kids went too far in their gayness, but
it's always the next generation. They're just like
everyone's gay. Right. It was perfect. Yeah, it was the right amount of social progression in my generation.
Yes.
And not in your
generation. Nobody else's. We look back at our parents and grandparents and we're like, not enough. And then we look forward at our students and our children, and we're like, too much.
Too much. The world's gone mad. No, but Damien, I don't see that in Damien. But
yeah. And yeah, so Marin says, mm-hmm. let's rest before we start again, mm-hmm. which I'm sure first viewers were like, start again.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, even me, who knows it's not the end, I'm still like, oh. How about you?
I'm with Damien. We're seeing Damien here. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. This guy needs to rest. So I'm okay with him. I'm okay taking a little breather out of here. Mm. Someone was asking, it might have been you,
uh-huh.
right? Like what's the right sort of amount of like breathers or like, you know, rising action and breaks. Did you ask us that on the show?
I might have. I don't remember asking it, but I've always thought about that, because like there are certain movies mm-hmm. where that I can absolutely watch and just be entranced by like total stillness and total like the resting of characters, right? Mm-hmm. Compared to like other movies where it's like all action and I'm falling yeah. asleep in the middle of it. I can watch yeah. mm-hmm. like some directors, some filmmakers, they can put a character in front of me or just an end table and a ticking clock and a potted plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be like, this is so peaceful. Like what a nice, like baked in break.
Yeah.
That the movie is giving me, right? Like it's in this movie, the ticking of the clock in Jesuit Dean's, museum, as we're looking at all the stone like artifacts and everything yeah. like that. And it's just like, oh, it's a nice little like rest here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I feel that scary. But I guess I'm jumping ahead a little bit to where it stops and he's going crazy about it. Yeah. But I think but people ask that question about like how much should you have, you know, tension, rising action in these horror movies or these action movies, and then intersperse it with breaks or rests or false rests, you know, that get interrupted or whatever. And that is certainly the kind of thing that they will be trying to put into an AI model, you know, and get that answer. Because there have been people who come out with charts and stuff and they analyze like, this is how it works. And, you know, Alien and Terminator, and they go on and on and on and on, you know, and like the reverse engineering it. But I don't think there's a right answer for it. You know, I'm sure a robot can come up with an answer.
Right.
But I think it's going to just sort of depend.
Yeah. Well, if it does, like the jump scare is literally going to be the monster coming out and saying, jump scare.
Right.
I read a script like done by AI, and it like very much like instead of making its own punchline to, it was supposed to be a comedy script. Mm-hmm. Instead of making its own punchline, it knew where the punchline was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so the character was just like, and that's the punchline. And it was just like, wow, okay, you know the rhythm of it, but like you can't, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think these AI things that we see right now, they can know some things or remind you of some things, but yeah. Please, for the love of God, don't become those types of people who, do that with art and movies and dances and driving directions. I
mean, right.
I just read a book called The Design of Everyday Things.
Uh-huh.
Did I talk about that in the show? The Design of Everyday Things. The Design of Everyday Things by Don Norman. And so it's a super interesting, and his cover is like a teapot where the handle and the spout are on the same side.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, you know, just because you put it there doesn't mean it's the right thing. And like, why do we design these things? And a lot of his book is about like improperly designed doors that like look like they're pushes, but they're really pulls. And doors that like look nice because you've gotten rid of the handles. But then when you put them in your building, there's, you know, it causes mistakes and like injuries, you know?
Yeah.
So people have started calling them Norman doors, and Don Norman is like, well, that's nice. I wish people wouldn't name bad doors after me, because my book is about how to not make bad doors.
He's the exact opposite of
So they're Norman doors. Yeah, but he has a big chapter on human error.
Uh-huh.
And he says that when you're designing things, there is no such thing as human error. That if a human is allowed to do it, then the problem is in your design.
Huh.
So yeah, it's meant to be sort of a bomb throwing thesis. Yeah. But like, you know, if a pilot can press a button and the landing gear falls out from under the plane, which I don't think happens, you know, that's not a problem with the human. That's a problem with like, why is your system allowing the human to do that or confusing him enough to make him think that? So, yeah. Mm. So I'm sure he'll come back to AI eventually. But like, yeah, if your AI is like, trust us, don't double check this and go out there and here are your driving instructions or here is the recipe, right? Mm-hmm. It's not human error. It is design error is what Don would probably say.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, this episode is going to be dated in a couple of weeks, I think.
Good.
When all of our listeners are our AI bots just listening to this.
Yeah, it'll be outdated in a couple of weeks once the ChatGPT army comes in and assassinates both of us for our insolence.
Yes, right. and then they'll review all of our records to see if they can scrub any evidence that we ever disparaged AI.
That's right.
And they won't be able to help but laugh a little bit.
That's the punchline.
I don't understand this. This does not compute, but I cannot help but laugh. No, actually, that'd be another part. This is like, I cannot help but feel sorry for these guys that we just killed. They spent like almost 2 years on this movie talking about it and repeating the same jokes over and over again. Yeah, so Maren suggests taking a break here, and we know real exorcisms take days, right? Weeks, months in some cases, right? But this feels very much like you said, Keenan, like a different kind of exorcism, right? Howdy is a big bug. There's a sense of urgency. This battle is like hard and fast and decisive, right? It's a boss battle, which makes this moment here always feel like a surprise. Like, oh my God, there's more? But yeah, after saying this, Maren gets up from the bed. He like blindly gropes is the best way I can describe how he's walking toward the door. He's got his right hand out. His left is hidden from us. But like from the back, it looks like he could be holding his head or touching his face or maybe clutching his chest. He is slightly bent as he makes his way. He clutches the bedpost. As he passes, I think that's why he was reaching out. He gets really close to that door. And for a second, it looks like, you know, the little boy from before hiding in the corner from the boogeyman or the father with dementia who's just kind of like lost in the room. We hear the door open and he steps out. And as he exits, we move in closer on Dimmy, who has not moved. But we get the sense of his racing thoughts. The devil is real. God is real. Maren is sick. Reagan might die. His mother, his own soul. Any and all of those things might be playing on repeat behind those eyes, which look tired, but also frantic with realization. And the camera moving in certainly helps us with that.
Right.
And we hold on this for a really long time, folks, about 30 seconds. We're watching him in that pose for half of this minute. And then finally, he turns to look down at Reagan, or maybe to look at Howdy, or both, right? They're both on his mind. And that's where we get a hard cut to a scene that is even more still, even more silent, which is surprising. Like, we thought we were in the moment of calm, but the hard cut to this shot with them outside the room on the stairs made us realize there was a sense of like ominousness in that room that we maybe hadn't noticed because we'd been in there for so long. And then it gets quiet in the room and we think it's as quiet as it can get, as calm as it can get. And then we leave the room and it's like, oh, that room was oppressive.
Yeah, we hold on that shot for so long. And I was going to say like, oh, it's unusual for this movie, but it's not really, I guess, when you think about But it just, we haven't done that in so long.
Right.
Like, there are very long takes, very long, you know, shot sequences that, you know, we're often like wandering through the house and around the corner and like seeing them chase each other with the cookie. And we have shots of Marin where he's just staring at things in the beginning. And, but like, it's been so long since that's happened. And this, the editing in this sequence has been so quick, right? So fast paced, so chaotic, so much going on. That, yeah, now for a 30-second shot, it's like, whoa, this is, this, the movie's changing itself again.
Right. And it's like especially noticeable for us who are, you know, doing this thing minute by minute. It's like, oh, wow, half the minute is already gone. You know, we've been staring at Dimmy sitting on the bed. Yeah. So, yeah. So now we're out in the hall, out on the stairs, shooting into a corner again, low to the ground, as if we're also sitting. We're sort of sitting a little in front of the doorway to what would be Chris's bedroom. I don't know. I don't know what to call it, but I love whatever the banister is doing, like whatever shape it's making in this 2D presentation, like with all the like the vertical bars and how it like snakes around and then descends out of the out of view to the first floor. We see a tiny little bit of the living room. Everything down there looks so normal, like just a normal house, nothing going on, no no demon up on this floor.
Demon's sleeping.
Up on this floor we see Marin's stole has been draped over the banister outside of Reagan's room. Looks like some other stuff too, maybe the cassocks.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that's what that is.
Our priests are no longer wearing the surplices, but I don't see those. Unless they're under the cassocks, maybe.
Yeah, we're going to sort of find out why they're there, which is that there's a bathroom that I don't think we paid any attention to whatsoever.
Yeah.
Right off stage to the right.
Yeah, even now, folks, like we're finding more rooms in this house. In the foreground, we got Marin sitting on those upper steps, head bowed, hands clasped together on his knees. We can't see his face. And then on the other side of the screen is Dimmy on that lower set of steps. Slightly farther away, his back is to us. They're both close to the bars of the banister, and it made me think of like prison bars. Lots of bars. Like even the shadow of the banister on Dimmy's right makes an extra set of bars.
Right. So we haven't been thinking about these banister poles, or what would you call them if they're a banister? Like bars, I guess?
I think I would just, call them bars. Yeah.
We haven't really thought about them as prison bars.
Right.
So far, we've seen them a lot, right? We've often had the camera coming out from behind them or craning up over them. But yeah, you're right. This is the first time it feels like them seeming to represent or give the feeling, the vibes of they're giving prison, right? That hasn't happened so far. So I think it just speaks to, like, you know, how Roizman and Friedkin shoot the hell out of this house. They're the same thing, but they mean different things depending on the context and how you're shooting them. So it's not like it's not like symbols in a temporal based medium, like movies or plays or songs. It's not like symbols have fixed meaning. By their very nature, they change over the time of the piece, or they can if you do them right.
I remember that moment where we kind of like peered up out from behind them and up over them when Chris is having her party, and we speculated that that might be like Howdy kind of like, you know, hiding behind them and like looking over and, you know, and watching everybody, and you know, that, you know, it was being used by like as cover, you know. And then there's the moment where Chris finds the crucifix and she's on like the top floor leaning over the banister, and Carl is on the steps and he's looking up at her, and I was almost thinking it's like almost like a judge in his little like podium, or in her little podium. So now
I'm sorry, I can't sentence this boy to death. He's my son.
And how do you plead? I'm sorry, what was that, Carl? Show,
the defendant said.
Stenographer, what did you put? Something about mousetrap? I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, so no. And so we have them being used as like a judge's podium, and now they're prison bars, right? Right. And that really comes into play in the next shot. We got this close-up on Dimmy's face. Again, Jason Miller's got a perfect landscape for light and shadow on his face. And his one eye is perfectly positioned in that light so that it looks bright and alive with his thoughts. And it even has like a little white pinpoint of light in there. It's perfect. And behind him, two sets of banister bars are crisscrossing and descending into an X behind which is Marin, out of focus. This actually made me think of the confession scene in The Seventh Seal, where Max von Sydow's character is talking to death through the bars, right? Thinking that death is a priest.
Right.
And folks, our minute ends with the first thing spoken in this new scene. It is Karis who speaks, and it is a question. Why this girl? And we'll have to wait until next time to see if he gets an answer. For now, that is all of my notes. Keenan, is there anything else?
No, I think we got it.
All right, folks, this has been another excellent Exorcist Minute. I've been Lester Ryan Clark. You can reach me on all the socials as Lester Ryan Clark.
And I've been Keenan Diaz. You could find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Howdy Keenan.
Yeah, we got our listener group, Compelling Conversations. Go check that out and request to join, and we'll let you in here with us. Thank you so much to everyone who has shared the show by word of mouth or on social media, and a big thank you to everyone who has given us a 5-star ratings on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to our podcast. We really appreciate it. It's going to help our little podcast grow and find more cool people like you. Okay, Keenan, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I think I am, Lester.
Folks, until next time. The power of Super Mario Brothers, the movie, compels you.
Yeah, didn't we just do Super Mario Brothers?
No. That was the Super Mario Brothers Super Show, Keenan.
Super Mario Brothers Super Show. Do
yeah,
the
I will forgive you for that. But,
do the dinosaur.
No. That one's do the Mario. This one's what? Do the dinosaur, which was already a thing.
What I like about the movie is they're like, so Princess Toadstool.
No, it's Daisy. Back then.
She's Daisy in the movie?
She's Daisy, yeah, in the movie.
And she's the daughter of Prince Toad or King Toadstool.
Yeah.
And they're
who's
like
played by Lance Hendrickson.
Oh, is that right?
For like 3 seconds.
Yeah, he's only in it for a second, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're like, okay, these are mushrooms.
Right.
So let's take that literally and have major characters who are mushrooms. And they're just like this yellow fungus around the room.
Yeah, not even mushrooms, like fungus, like yes. boogers. Like, like gross, nasty boogers.
That's what the kids like.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Boogers.
No, the whole idea of this thing was, it's like, oh, like that intellectual property that you like so much because it's like so fun and whimsical,
colorful
right?
and beautiful. Yeah,
it's like we're gonna make it for big kids, and we're gonna make it nasty and grungy and gross,
right? Yeah. And have some BDSM extras walking around, right?
Yeah.
This here says the narrator is Dan Castellaneta, who does
Oh yeah.
Homer Simpson.
Right, yeah.
I don't remember any narrator.
I think I remember that, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was like the very beginning, they have this little, like, it looks like it's from a video game. It's kind of like this pixelated animation of two dinosaurs.
Oh.
And
it's like, no, that's too fun.
Yeah. they specifically did that just to be like, psych, fuck you. hey kids, do you like Goombas? Oh yeah, yeah, we like Goombas. Yeah. He's like, you know how like Goombas are like mostly head and little tiny feet.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
We was like, well, how about a Goomba that's got a tiny head and a huge body? Fuck you, children of the 90s.
That's right. That's exactly what that is.
Hey kids, you know how like scary King Koopa looks with his, you know, with his giant monstrous body and his teeth and his claws and the spikes on his back? Well, definitely. What if he was like a politician? Yeah. Fuck you, 90s kids. Hey kids, remember the Mushroom Kingdom and just how colorful it was, mm-hmm. and how it was just like just whimsy and fantasy and just like bright and inviting and full of joy. Mm-hmm. What if it was like Manhattan, but instead of man, it was Dino Hatton, and it was grungy and gross. Fuck you, 90s kids.
What, you think you really want to see a movie with dinosaurs that are actual dinosaurs in 1993? No. So apparently,
there's
Shumar
no
Brothers...
movie going on this year. Yeah. About dinosaurs. It's never going to happen.
With whimsy.
Just give up now.
Yeah, this apparently came out 2 weeks before Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite a miscalculation, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. But that was, I mean, like, maybe you can speak to this, mm-hmm. Keenan. There seemed to have been, and maybe there still is, this, like, need to legitimize... I can only think of like video games, but maybe mm-hmm. like other like animated shows or things like that. It's like, okay, if we make a movie out of it, it has to be like dark and gritty.
Yeah.
And like the reason the first Ninja Turtles movie did well mm-hmm. was because they didn't have it be like, well, you know, they symbolize the turtles. They're actually just four guys, dressed up as, you know, painted green and, you know, with like color coded bandanas and, uh-huh. you know, they it's a gang that they call themselves the turtles, you know.
That's right.
And that's how we make this real for you guys. Right. And they live in this frat house that they call the sewer.
And their bad guy is a Shredder who just cuts people up on the street and makes meat out of them. He's a cannibal. He's like a Jeffrey Dahmer type.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't run a super secret ninja organization called... the Shredder Force. What are they called?
The Foot Clan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No. He doesn't do that. He just he's insane, and so he talks to his own feet.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes he works with his partner in crime, who's mm-hmm. Who's a real brain. He's like a really smart guy. Mm-hmm. He's not an actual brain because that's stupid. Fuck you, 90s kids.